Let's make it happen, Captain.
From deep inside the Death Star, I'm Larry Larson.
I'm Gov Maharaj.
And welcome to Defrag. And today we've got Billy Goats Gruff staring at me.
Which is I can't awesome. Tell. Is it three goats? Is it four goats? It's one, two, three, four.
God, nice. So, yeah, it's been a while since we've had a weird animal looking at me in the show. So this is a nice return to that. All right, so... we've got a lot of questions this week. Let's get started. From Evil Dictator, who commented to the show last week, he said, physical memory, not available, but 4 gig limit because it's not addressable. Oh, really? And then he links to the physical address extension Wikipedia post.
Absolutely true, except PAE isn't available on client SKUs. It was special for server and SQL.
And software's got to be written for that.
It's got to be written. Well, not just the software, drivers, which of course is software, but everything on the machine has to be able to handle that. As soon as you start throwing drivers on and software on that can't properly address it, you're going to get things like pointer truncation issues, overflows because you're casting an N64 into an N32, high-order bits get lopped off. You just get really buggy issues and
then
crashes.
Magic Andre said, you know, you can do a search for some patch thing.
Yes.
Look, man, if you want to do a search for a patch, you want to patch your stuff up and use your extra couple, you know, 100 mega memory, more power to you. It's all
but
you. But it's
note
not...
that this patch is not a Microsoft patch.
Yeah, this is it's not really supported, so
it's not supported and you will hit issues with it.
Yeah.
So I mean, is it worth it as opposed to just moving to a 64-bit OS?
Maybe. Maybe someone wants to do it. But the beauty of it is you can do what you like, but we're gonna give you we're not gonna go wobbly here, so we're not gonna do the patch stuff. But yeah, I mean, it's right there. You can follow Magic Andre and you can do a search for that if that's something you want to do. All right, D-Tower said, one thing I liked about Mesh was the ability to sync arbitrary folders. SkyDrive needs everything to be rooted in a special SkyDrive folder. I already had all my music in a different folder and I didn't want to move it, so I used SysInternals Junction.exe tool to make a symlink from the SkyDrive music folder to where it actually lives, and it works perfect. Nice tip.
Yep, and that... shouldn't actually pose any problems because, of course, it doesn't really matter where it lives on your file systems.
Yeah.
SkyDrive is just a complete copy.
Yeah.
So that should be perfectly fine. There should not be any issues with that. You might have some problems if you're doing an upgrade, but that would be easy enough to recover.
Yeah. Nice tip, though, D-Tower. Send me your email and I'll send you a Channel 9 guy. From David G says, just curious if there's any key differences between the new SkyDrive app and Live Mesh. And I don't know off the top of my head what all the differences are, and if I did, I'd just be speaking for a product team. So why don't I take a camera over there and we'll talk to them sometime soon and figure out what are all the differences.
I think one of the key differences with Mesh, though, is that that's supposed to sync between multiple machines.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just a single machine to SkyDrive.
Yeah.
I suppose you could really get funky and do Mesh and SkyDrive together for, you know, multiple copies across machines and your SkyDrive account. But, you know, if you're doing just SkyDrive with one machine, you could conceivably use SkyDrive with multiple machines, and your SkyDrive source is your sync source that then gets synchronized across all your machines.
Yeah.
So it's just, you know, a different method. Mesh also allows the remote desktop part going into other machines. So when you register your machine with Mesh, you know, you can do a remote desktop across the internet to it.
Yeah.
So that's another key difference.
Cool. Okay. And then we had one from Igor. He says, hi, Gov. Can you please elaborate in more detail about using EFS and SkyDrive? I was able to set up EFS on one PC but saw unencrypted files on another PC via SkyDrive.
So I use a method not exactly like this, but it's very similar. It is basically using RAR files or zip files that then get synchronized along with a PowerShell script in the task scheduler.
Mm-hmm.
We can leave a link to this particular person's site. I found it useful in some cases. You might want to modify it for your particular needs.
Yeah, okay. And then from the show before, we had a comment from Lee Campbell who said, VHD boot only seems to work in Windows 7 Ultimate. This seems to be a big secret, but I've wasted hours trying when I only had Windows 7 Pro. apologies for that. We should have been very clear. It's Windows 7 Ultimate and Enterprise, versions that will work with. So
I mean, generally speaking, home users wouldn't be using a VHD.
Yeah.
So it's one of those extra features that we generally feel that an end user shouldn't have to pay for.
Yeah. And we thought everyone watching the show had MSDN subscriptions. Sorry. From Pedro, he says, hey guys, I was wondering if there's a way to have the desktop wallpaper show in the lock screen. This worked on XP, but 7 just shows the default image.
There is. If you Bing, I don't have the site up right now.
We'll link to it.
It's we added this capability in Windows 7. It's not strictly designed for home users to do it, but it's the exact same mechanism. It's a mechanism for OEMs to show their own branded screen on the lock screen, as well as while booting up. But you can follow the exact same method. There are some constraints as to the size of the wallpaper. If you're on a multi-monitor display, it will only show on your primary monitor, because when you lock your machines, all your other screens go off except for your primary monitor.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, not any kind of new constraint, but it does allow you to have your own lock screen.
Okay, cool. All right, from Hernando, he says, I work for a company providing support for a variety of customers all over the globe, from Europe to Asia to South America, which of course involves using remote desktop to remote servers. The annoying part, which you might already guess, is the keyboard layout that always is that of the remote server and never the one of the PC I'm using. So I'd like to know, what's the rationale behind this? Issuing SQL commands to check scripts and simple command prompt commands turns out to be so cumbersome that I can't believe anyone has not noticed this before. I'd like to know if there's a workaround for it.
I did do some digging, and in fact, we had the opposite approach in XP in 2003, and we actually made a conscious decision to switch the other way. I've not actually found a way to turn it back to the XP mode. I believe it has to do with just a larger architectural changes in the operating system.
Yeah.
That it made more sense to do it in this manner, as opposed to changing the input on the fly from the host machine to the client machine.
So could you do some kind of PowerShell script or something that on the remote machine that changes the keyboard layout when you log in, and then...
So the problem there is that the client machine would have to know what the language of the connecting machine is.
Yeah.
So it would not be exactly straightforward. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you could manually run a PowerShell script that would do that.
Yeah.
In fact, if you run... MSGS. This is the remote desktop client. What you can do under programs is start the following program on a connection, mm-hmm. and you could actually have it run a script that would automatically set the keyboard input to be whatever language that you prefer.
You just
have that on your machines that you're connecting to.
Yeah.
And if you have it in a particular user home directory, then everybody that's connecting can switch their input as they see fit.
Cool. Okay. All right. Next one from Mark. He says, I'm running a Windows 8 Consumer Preview 64-bit on HP laptop. Like most people, I want to use my PC in an earth-friendly way, saving energy whenever possible. I make sure that hibernation sleep settings are aggressive as possible, and I use this laptop almost all day, but then I put it to sleep before I go to sleep. Every morning I wake up and my PC is already awake with the BitLocker login showing. I use BitLocker to protect my files. The PC is connected to the LAN on 802.11 wireless. The PC is plugged into AC. I need your help trying to figure out what is waking my PC.
So what you can do is run the PowerCFG WAC energy report. It will tell you what the wake timers are. What you can do is, under the power management side, is change your advanced power settings and go under sleep, and then check the allow wake timers. You can actually disable it when you're plugged in. That will not wake your machine on timed events. So if you're using your laptop with, say, Media Center at 3 o'clock in the morning or 4 o'clock in the morning goes and does an update of the electronic program guide. Mm-hmm. So things of that nature, maintenance tasks, Windows updates, all that kind of stuff. What we would prefer to do is actually not disable that, because this is what we call our maintenance hour.
Mm-hmm.
when the machine is not in use, we do want to wake it up, do our stuff, and then restart or sleep it again.
Yeah.
Now, what may have happened is that we called for a restart, you know, because your BitLocker screen is running.
Yeah.
But of course, if you have BitLocker, it can't go back into the OS and then go back to sleep again.
Yeah.
So, yes, that is somewhat of an issue. What you could do is disable your PIN on BitLocker. It doesn't make it as secure, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But then that will allow it to boot back into Windows and then go to sleep.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Next question. Do you think it would be worth putting an SSD into an older Core 2 Duo laptop? It's a Lenovo 281-53YU ThinkPad T400 with Core 2 Duo at 2400 with 2 gig of RAM running Windows XP. Yeah, I think an SSD would help anything. But
I think the thing that would help it even more is get that sucker running on Win 7.
Exactly. Yeah. Put Windows 7 on that. What are you doing with that XP? And then...
Because that's not all that old.
No, it's not. I mean...
Core 2 Duo, what? That's like 2007, 2008?
Just Core 2 alone. I mean, I'm running Windows 7 on an old tablet PC that's a 1 gigahertz. So it runs great. So, I mean, it's not great, but it's not as bad as, you know, running old... XP on it, but yeah, I think an SSD would help make it a little bit faster.
Absolutely,
it can't hurt, definitely. But yeah, I mean, SSD is usually when you look at the Windows Experience Index, it's usually the hard drive that's your bottleneck most of the time, anyway. So,
the Windows Index Experience Index is somewhat misleading if all you do is you look at the big score.
Yeah.
Because I'm willing to bet on that particular laptop, he's got maybe not as powerful video graphics.
Yeah.
Right? So that's going to bring the entire score way down.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you'll want to go and check the individual scores on the hard drive and memory and everything. But yeah, go for the SSD. I mean, they're coming down in price. If you're not storing, you know, terabytes, mm-hmm. you know, well, the laptop, you got pretty much a max of 1 terabyte or 2 terabytes anyways.
Yeah, and the other thing that I'd say, too, is if you don't want to spend as much money as an SSD is going to cost and you want to speed it up a little bit, bumping up that 2 gig of RAM would probably be a little bit cheaper and make it run a little bit
maybe
smoother.
Replacing the 2 gig of RAM, because if you're just going to add memory to it, you generally have to match the speed.
Yeah, yeah.
And if that is slow RAM or slower RAM, you could actually rip out the 2, replace it with a single 4, assuming that the machine can take it.
Yeah.
And remember, what you can also do when you pull out that old drive, stick it into a caddy so you don't lose it. You know, and just hook it up via USB, and then you kind of get a free external drive, or at least a very low-cost external drive at that point.
Yeah, very cool. All right, pick of the week time. Gov, you got a pick of the week here. I'm loving this one.
This is not related to... Well, this is somewhat related to software.
We always talk about weird stuff like
but
this.
We talk about weird stuff.
Pick of the week time.
This is stuff that really gets my imagination going, right? And when your imagination is going, it helps you in all sorts of areas. This website called shapeways.com... is a 3D printing and manufacturing site. The really cool thing about it is that you can upload your own files, and you can create these files in a Libre, 3D Studio Max, AutoCAD, yada, 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 any sort of modeling tool. And you upload these files, and they're able to make the exact specified part in plastic, metal. Let's take a look at the materials that they use here. You know, this is a metal with aluminum dust in it. This is an acrylic. You have stainless steel. You have this really cool sandstone. I mean, really, come
ceramic,
on.
Ceramic, you can make your ceramic gun.
Please
don't
do that. You can have a glass.
Glass, that's very, very cool.
And they keep adding new materials.
So what if I have a 3D printer? Can I download these and do it myself?
Absolutely.
That would be very cool, because Clint now has a 3D printer in his office that we all have to listen to all day. It makes a horrible racket. And
what materials does he use in his 3D printer?
He's got plastic wires going it.
Okay, so it's a 3D printer and extruder.
I don't know. I think it's the Make 3D printer.
Okay.
But it's very cool, and I'm always looking for something that he can print out for me that'd be interesting, so this would be a good one. The little Lego guy electric guitar, that's good. I like that.
That is super cool.
It's kind of big for an electric guitar, but all right.
So the thing that I find it super useful for is you know, nowadays in tools or in pretty much anything, what used to be metal parts have been replaced with plastic due to cost and, you know, lightening it up and all that kind of stuff. Can't tell you, like, I'm holding a reciprocating saw. And, you know, 20 years ago, it was a nice, solid hunk of metal. You know, that would pretty much go through anything and survive. And now it's just plastic. So practically the whole thing is plastic. Anyways.
So you could make your own version and then replace it?
What tends to happen is, you know, one critical part, because it's plastic, tends to break. You know, it's a high-use part. And it's really expensive to try to replace, or you go to the manufacturer and they don't even create the part for it anymore. Or you have to shell out another $150 just to buy a whole new tool, which pretty wasteful, I think. Anyways, you can, you know, take the part that you have, the broken part that you have.
Scan it with your Kinect. Should be able to. I mean, I'm sure there's got to be an app out there that'll make a 3D model from Kinect.
Well, there are applications that will take it, you know, from pictures and will create a, you know, an approximation of it. And you can go through and create the exact measurements. Anyways, you can take that, you can take that kind of file, give it to these folks, and they'll just create it for you at a, generally speaking, a pretty good cost. You know, the remember the top from Inception? Some of these things are pretty simple. You could go pretty much buy them anywhere. You wouldn't need it for yourself.
I could see people making a lot of stuff from, like, you know, cosplay and their favorite video game. And I always wanted, you know, the gun from Space 1999 or something.
Right.
To make that.
But, I mean, look at this. A three-axis camera gimbal.
That's awesome.
You know, somebody decided, hey, I need this. I need, you know, and I need it custom for my... for my work, and nobody makes it. Well, guess what? I'm going to make it. And they uploaded it, and they apparently are sharing it with other people because they think it's useful. But, I mean, specific mounts.
Yeah, that's awesome, but you know, I don't know if... I hope that's not plastic. Maybe that's something else, one of the other materials.
Considering
what people do with GoPros
with
now.
With GoPro, right. I mean, yeah, I'd probably make it out of stainless steel.
Yeah.
But some of their plastics are, you know, more of a polyurethane, so it's, like, super hard. It's not just a... you know, simple plastic.
Yeah.
But these kinds of things, you know, you're trying to create something custom. It's not quite working, you know, whatever existing materials, or it would take too long for you to mill it yourself. This is perfect.
Very cool. Awesome. All right, so I got another pick of the week, and this is the Arsenal of Halo 4. So you can do a search for it. Arsenal of Halo 4. There you go.
First one?
So, yeah. So, anyway, you can see some of the new rifles that are going to be in Halo 4, which is very cool. They've got an assault rifle, and I think I saw a railgun. Yeah, railgun. Awesome. Yeah, this is... so, get ready.
Oh, yeah.
Get set. Book your vacation now. I can't wait for Halo 4, but yeah, a railgun would be very nice to have in Halo. So
an asymmetric recoilless carbine.
Yeah. Sniper rifle, we got the DMR, the battle rifle, the assault rifle. So just
splitting
a little...
open heads like cantaloupes from 3 miles away.
Yeah. Yeah, so there you go. If you can't wait for Halo 4, you can get a little bit of a fix in here. And see the hardware that you're going to be able to tote around in there. So that's awesome.
I cannot wait for that to come out. I can only imagine the kind of updates that they're looking at. Because the last one was the Combat Evolved reimaging, which was a phenomenal job. You know, I'm in my game. I bought it practically the first day they came out. I'm constantly switching back from the original Halo and the reimaged just to see like how they were able to add all the new textures and. You know, the speed doesn't change at all. It's just awesome how well they were able to update it.
And my favorite part, 3D.
Yeah.
So we both have 3D TVs now, and that's a lot of fun.
It is.
So, yeah, looking forward to this. So, all right, that's the show for this week. If you'd like to email us, you can email us at defragshow@microsoft.com, or you can leave us notes in the show notes for the show. But we like the email if you have a problem so we can go back and forth and get all the questions answered.
And also, when you're sending the emails, if you can put in a general list of the apps and drivers that you've installed, it really goes a long way in for me trying to repro the problem that you're having. otherwise, you know, unless it's relatively straightforward, it's pretty complex to try and figure out what stuff that might be installed that could be interfering with the issue that you're having.
Very cool. See you next week.